Super Bowl 51 is this Sunday, and for our bonus weekend podcast, we thought we would revisit three football interviews that may allow you to see the game a little differently. In 2006, I spoke with sportscaster and former football star Pat Summerall about what happens after you leave the field. In 2013, Nicholas Dowdoff talked about what he uncovered while he spent an entire year with the New York Jets. And in 2015, former NFL player George Kuntz Jr. joined me to discuss his book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL. Enjoy. Pat Summerall has one of the most familiar voices and faces in sports broadcasting history. He's worked as an announcer for over 40 years, covering football, tennis, and golf for CBS and Fox. And before that, he was a successful pro football place kicker for the New York Giants. He's written an autobiography called Summerall On and Off the Air, in which he describes his sports career, his lifelong battle with alcoholism, and his recent spiritual rebirth. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. By the way, the book is published by Nelson. And I was surprised that the first pages of your book weren't about football or broadcasting. You instead talk about being an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Do you feel your struggle with alcoholism has tainted your achievements in broadcasting and football?
Oh, I don't know. I think the way that people regard the disease probably to some people might have. But I think the fact that I've been able to overcome it certainly is something that I wanted to share with people and let them know that it can be beaten. And I'm one of those who've beaten it.
Didn't you help Mickey Mantle conquer his alcohol problems at the end of his life?
Yes, I did. Mickey and I became very good friends. Well, we actually met each other when he was in his teens and I was in my teens. We were playing minor league baseball. That was the beginning of our friendship. Then during his time with the Yankees, my time here in New York with the Giants, we got to be closer friends. And then I moved to Dallas and he moved to Dallas after he retired. And we became golfing buddies and drinking buddies and very, very good friends.
So how many sports did you play? You were a minor league baseball player. What position did you play?
I was a first baseman.
And then you were just a place kicker? Well, when you were in college, you played on both offense and defense.
Right.
That's the way the game was played.
In the National Football League, I played full-time defensive end for the Cardinals before I was traded to the Giants. And I was a tight end, a tight end and a place kicker with the Giants. In those days, the specialty days were not on us yet. They had a player limit of 33, so you couldn't afford a specialist, a kicker or a punter or anything like that. So you had to play as well as kick.
And now they have more coaches on teams than they used to have players in those days.
Yeah. We had five assistants when I was with the Giants.
Yeah, but now, I don't know.
They have 19, most of them.
Wow. Do you think that has changed the sport? You've seen, over your career, you have seen football change so much. You've seen pro football go from being a kind of second-rate sport to being perhaps the most popular one in America.
Well, I never thought it was a second-rate sport because that was what I was playing. But yes, it's changed so much. The game itself, the tackling, the basics of the game hasn't changed very much. The equipment has changed and improved to such a degree that you're much more mobile now. The players are bigger and faster. That's changed, but the game itself hasn't changed that much.
I mean, the strategies haven't gotten all that much more complicated?
Strategies are not that much different. You have a specialist where you used to have somebody playing, let's say, a wide receiver who might be fatigued. Now, all he has to do is hold his hand up and somebody replaces him.
But also, you had in those days 240-pound defensive linemen.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody on the offensive line who was close to 300 pounds was considered very overweight. Today,
fat.
Yeah. Today, 300-pound is normal.
You can't play in the offensive line today unless you're over 300. Really, there are very few.
So do you think that the great players, and you played with some of the greatest of all time,
yeah,
do you think that they could have made it today, or would they have just beefed up so much more that they would have looked different than they did?
Some of the players that I played with were gifted enough to play today. The diets are better. The coaching is better. The equipment is so much lighter. So it's hard to compare eras.
Well, even kicking, nowadays, people are soccer kickers, and
it's a totally different motion from what it used to be.
You kicked it with their the front toe, like Lou Groza and all the other greats of that time.
Right.
So
right.
would you have been a better kicker, do you think, if you had known about the soccer stuff?
Oh, I think so. In fact, after I retired and playing in the front yard with my kids and what have you, I tried it soccer style. And yes, I would have been much better had I been a soccer style kicker.
Were you drinking throughout your playing career?
Not much. Not much. Just an occasional beer or, you know, some time with teammates or something like that. Not much.
So when did it change for you?
I think when I got into the broadcasting business and had to entertain clients. I'm not blaming the broadcasting business, but that was when I started a serious undertaking of a drink. And one thing led to another at lunch and then after work and then on the weekends. And as I started to do golf and tennis and places where there were a lot of drinks available, I took advantage of those things.
And there's a lot of hard drinking in, or was, I don't know if it's still the case, in broadcasting.
Well, after
it used to
hours,
be in the newspaper business as well.
I'm sure. But yeah, there were a lot of idle hours when you were in strange cities and strange places and didn't know anybody, and so you spent your time at the bar trying to entertain yourself. And that's sort of how it became habitual.
Did it affect your job performance?
I didn't think it did. I'm sure it did, but I didn't think it did, and at that time particularly.
Charlie Parker, the great jazz man who had serious problems with drugs and alcohol, said that he always thought that he was playing better when he was high, and then he listened to some old records when he had kicked drugs for a time.
Mm-hmm.
He went back, unfortunately. And he said he could hear that he wasn't playing very well at all.
Well, the thing about it is, I think that you think it's not affecting you. You think you can handle it. You think that it's not going to affect your performance. I know it affected the way I prepared and the time that I spent preparing for a broadcast. I know that for a fact because I just didn't feel like doing those things. But as far as performance on the air, I don't think, I didn't think at that time I was ever affected.
And were any of your colleagues concerned ever?
No.
They probably were drinking as much as you were.
Not as much, or not as often. But no, nobody ever said anything to me.
My guest is Pat Summerall. His book, Summerall On and Off the Air, is published by Nelson Books, which is a division of Thomas Nelson Publishers. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you see any similarities between alcohol abuse and drug abuse with athletes? Because one is intended to enhance performance, and the other obviously has a negative effect on performance.
When I was in recovery at the Betty Ford Center, about half of the so-called inmates, is what I called them, including me, were there for drug abuse. And alcohol is a drug, after all. It's a foreign substance you put in your body. And there were similarities. The cures are similar. The remedies are similar. Some successful, some not. Thank goodness mine was.
Well, steroids are another kind of drug abuse that we're talking
performance
about.
Performance enhancing, yes. Yeah. I don't know about steroids.
Well, they weren't around when
no,
you were playing.
I suspect that
players would have taken them because there's always that desire by players to get that little extra edge.
Well, if the guy playing across from you know, is taking advantage of steroids, it makes him more able to work out longer, more tolerant of pain. If he's doing it, then I have to do it. That's the way they approach, because if I'm going to play against you and I'm going to beat you, I've got to be just as strong and just as quick as you are.
When you were broadcasting, did you become aware of these sorts of changes in sports?
There were some times that I thought, particularly during the NBA, that there were some people who were not performing as well as they should, and they thought they were. I don't know if it was steroids or what it was, but I thought that there's something wrong. We're not getting the best out of these guys. I was aware that something was going on. I don't know what it was. I didn't know what it was.
What led you to decide to enter the Betty Ford Clinic?
There was an intervention led by one of my former working partners. A group of people got together, confronted me with the things that they had seen me do, and they were frankly afraid that I was killing myself. Because I wasn't taking care of myself physically. I had become far less patient. My morals had deteriorated. My personal standards had deteriorated.
They were on a short fuse, you say.
Yeah, and they got together, and we had a meeting in Camden, New Jersey, as a matter of fact, 14 people that I respected and was afraid of in some cases, some of my bosses, and they wrote letters and read them to me about things that they had seen me do, and they thought that I should go for some counseling, go somewhere for some help. My daughter's letter is the thing that really turned the intervention around when she said lately, in social situations, "I'm sorry, we have the same last name." And I thought, my gosh, if that's the case of my own family, I better do something about it.
And you hadn't been all that aware of this as a problem?
Oh, I think every person who fights that disease is aware. They think, as I thought, that I can quit any time I want to. I can stop whenever I feel like it. I just don't want to. And I had said to myself a number of times, well, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm not going to do it anymore. But I always did it. If they hadn't confronted me, I probably would not have gone for help. And I'm so glad that they did.
And when was that? What year?
1992, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then you also found God.
That was part of the recovery, the realization that somebody was talking to my conscience and telling me the difference between right and wrong, and I wasn't really sure who that was. And then I discovered there was a higher power, there was somebody talking to my conscience, there was somebody helping me make the right choice. And then as I read the Bible, there were two books we could read. One was the Alcoholics Anonymous Bible, and the other was the Holy Bible. And I got tired of reading about stories about people doing the same things that I had done, so I started to read the Bible. And there were a lot of questions, and there were a lot of answers, too.
So you had yourself baptized for a second time.
Right, right.
Do you now see part of your mission to spread Christianity?
Yeah, I had a liver transplant. I had surgery for a liver transplant 2 years ago. And while I was waiting for the liver transplant, the question came to my mind, why am I getting another chance at life? Because I've lived a good life. I've had a great life. I've done a lot of things. I've accomplished a lot of things. Why does somebody have to die for me to live? Why am I getting another chance? And there were two friends of mine who happened to be pastors standing at the foot of my bed when I was at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. And I posed that question to them. I asked them, why do you think I'm getting another chance at life? And almost in unison, as if they had practiced it, they said, because God's not through with you yet. There's a lot more work God has for you to do. And I thought about that, and that sort of stunk in, and then I kept getting more and more impatient about, if God has something for me to do, when's he going to tell me, and when am I going to start? And over the years since that operation, I think he has told me what to do. Things like write this book, things like appear at meetings and AA meetings, for example, and church meetings, and to spread just what happened to me. That's my job. That's my assignment, I think.
So if you had a colleague who still had an alcohol problem, and you told him what you think he should do,
right?
Do you think he would have reacted the same way? He would react the same way you might have 15 or 20 years ago?
I have no way of knowing. I've had friends who've gone as a result of association with me, and I feel like that's part of God's assignment to be able to help people like that. And I've had a number of people ask me, what was it like at the Betty Ford's, and Mickey Mantle is one of them. What was it like, and what did you learn, and you know, what's treatment all about? Did you have any fun? To which I said, no, you're not going to have fun. You're going to get well.
Well, I remember talking to Mickey's widow and one of his sons. How many sons does he have?
He had four. Two of them have passed away.
I had one of his sons here, and they talked about how difficult he was to live with for many of the years when the
right.
alcohol was really bad.
Right.
And you have had the same problem with your family.
Well, because of our association, Mickey was such a good friend, he went to the Betty Ford Center, and for the last 18 months that he lived, he didn't touch any whiskey or any kind of alcohol.
My guest is Pat Summerall. He's written a book called Summerall On and Off the Air. It is published by Nelson Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
WNYC is supported by
Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the best cancer care anywhere. Outpatient cancer care facilities are also in New Jersey, Westchester, and on Long Island. 800-525-2225 or mskfirst.org. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, for 85 years helping to provide safe and efficient regional transportation. More at panynj.info. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Look what we're doing. Podcasting helps you hear the radio you love when you want to hear it. You can listen to many of our shows anytime, anywhere, on demand. Check out WNYC.org to learn more about how to hear your favorite shows. WNYC On Demand is made possible by Open from American Express.
Earlier this year, neuroscientists attached sensors to the conductor, musicians, and audience members of the Boston Symphony. The goal was to measure emotional responses to music. Well, today on Soundcheck, Why Puccini Can Leave You Breathless, Literally. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 WNYC. We're back with Pat Summerall, who has written a kind of a memoir, kind of a self-help book. It's called On and Off the Air, and it's published by Nelson Books. You played in the 1958 championship game against the Baltimore Colts,
right,
when you were with the Giants,
right,
a game many people think is the best in history. What do you think? You've been in the broadcast booth for many years. How would you rank that game, that 1958 game?
Well, as you said, a lot of people say it was the best game, the greatest game ever played. I don't think it was the greatest game ever played by any means. It was the first to go into overtime. That's what made it, I think, so famous. We, the Giants, had a tough road to get into the championship game. The Colts had, in the meantime, clinched their division before the season was over, so they had two or three weeks to rest. We were tired. We were fatigued. And I thought that we were lucky, number one, to be in the game, number two, for it to be as close as it was. So I don't think, technically, as you look at football games, and this was great and that was great, the drive that won the game for the Colts, that was conducted by John Unitas and Raymond Berry, was probably one of the greatest drives that's ever been put together in the history of football. But the game itself was rather sloppy, I thought. Certainly not the greatest game ever played. I mean, although I was a part of it.
Perhaps because it was just so exciting. And
well,
also because it was New York, don't you think? It was
New
different
York
playing in New York, wasn't it?
Pardon?
Wasn't it different playing in New York?
Oh, sure. We, the Giants, had become over the course of that year sort of the darlings of New York. It was a discovery of that period of time how good and how entertaining pro football could be. Every game was a sellout. That game in particular brought the interest not only of New York but of the country to what a great game pro football is.
Mm-hmm. In those days, I guess football players started looking like larger than life characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Charlie Connolly, Sam Huff.
Right. Both teammates.
Yeah. Wyatt Tittle wasn't with the team yet.
Yes,
he was.
Not that year, but he came 2 years later.
And, of course, Johnny Unitas, as you said.
Unitas was the conductor of the Colts offense.
So how old were you when you decided to retire from football?
I was 31.
Very young.
Right. I could have played as a kicker. I could have probably played another 7 or 8 years. I had two kids. We were living in a hotel in the Bronx. It wasn't a very good life. Nobody made that much money. I had an opportunity to go to work for CBS. And I took advantage of that. And it was what turned out to be a special life. But I just had enough of being sore on Thursday and Friday from the previous week. And I'd had enough of the train. I was living in Florida at the time, and we moved to a New York hotel. It wasn't the most glamorous life in the world that it seemed to be. So I just had enough of it.
Today, of course, you would have made enough money to have stayed for the next 10 years.
Oh, I would have stayed, and I would have made enough money to set myself for the rest of life.
Now, why did CBS want you to work as a broadcaster?
Well, I really don't know, but I'm so glad they did.
I mean, had you thought of becoming a broadcaster after you retired?
No, we had played a preseason game. We, the Giants, had played a preseason game in Newark, played the Packers in Newark, and we were training at Bear Mountain, and we had 3 or 4 days before we had to be back at Bear Mountain in training camp, and I happened to be in a hotel with my roommate, who was Charlie Connolly, the quarterback, and the telephone rang. I was lying on the bed watching television. Telephone rang, and I answered the phone, and Charlie was in the shower. And this voice, I had no idea who it was, said, could he speak to Charlie? And I said, he's in the shower. I'll give him a message. So this gentleman said, remind him that he's supposed to be at CBS this afternoon at 4 o'clock to read an audition script for a 5-minute radio show. And I said, I'll be glad to tell him. And I was about an inch from hanging up the phone, and I heard him say something else. I couldn't make out what it was, but I put the phone back to my ear, and he said, what are you doing this afternoon? And I said, I don't know. I'm going off with the guys somewhere. He said, why don't you come along and read the script along with Charlie and two more teammates. There are going to be three of you, now four, to read the same script. So I went, and they liked the way I read and the way I sounded, and so they hired me.
But, you know, that there's one thing reading the script. There's another thing doing play-by-play of a football game. I remember when Marty Glickman talked about how he would work for long, long hours with former football players to teach them how to do the basics of calling a game.
Well, I had some great teachers in the beginning. When I first started, I started on radio, which is a great education. You learn how to read.
Radio is still the best, I have to tell you that.
Yeah, I think so. But then when I started to work doing Giant games, I worked with Chris Schenkel, who was a great instructor and a good teacher, taught me a lot about preparation and how to go about preparing. Then after Chris left and went to another network, they put me with Jack Buck, who was a legend. And Jack and I spent 4 or 5 years together. I was the analyst. He was the play-by-play man. And then they sent me to work with Ray Scott, who was one of the best, I think, ever. And I learned a lot, absorbed a lot from Ray Scott about broadcasting, about how to conduct and do play-by-play.
And then you have to learn how to do interviews as
well. Oh, sure. Well, Art Linkletter was a great help to me when I was at CBS about doing interviews, about interviewing children. He said, you have to listen to what the children say because you never know what they're going to say. And if you're not listening, they'll lead you somewhere where you never thought you'd go. So he was a great help to me. Then in the middle of the year, I was back after Ray Scott left. I was working back again with Jack Buck, and the boss at CBS called me into his office and said, I got to split you and Jack Buck up because you sound too much alike. And I can't tell who's talking. So I said in the middle of the year, if you're going to split us up, if that's what you want to do, I think I'd like to try to do play-by-play. And I thought they'd wait 6 months or so and let me practice and warm up. He said, well, if we're going to do it, let's do it next week. So in the middle of the season, I started to do play-by-play.
And was it easy to move
into? Well, because I had had such great teachers and because I was comfortable and because I knew how to prepare, I worked with Tom Brookshire the next week. And we were successful.
Was the early transition difficult? There must have been times when you thought, gee, I'd like to go out there on the field again, or I wish I were coaching.
I thought about coaching, and I did coach the Rams for 2 weeks. And I decided after 2 weeks that's not what I wanted to do. I had already started to do some broadcasting, and I thought that's the direction that I wanted to go in. But I had to get coaching out of my system, which I did very quickly.
And then you wound up working some of the most historic broadcasts.
Right.
You worked the first Super Bowl game, didn't you?
Yep.
And you were in at the start of Monday Night Football.
I did not do Monday Night Football.
Didn't you do interviews before and after?
No. I never worked for ABC. Ah. And they had Monday Night Football, so.
Oh, well.
I was not a part of that.
But working the first Super Bowl, did you have any sense that this was going to be something momentous? Because football had gone through an earlier realignment when teams like the Cleveland Browns and Los Angeles Rams.
Not alone. I knew that the Super Bowl was a game that the Packers, who were in the first Super Bowl, I knew Vince Lombardi. I had played for him with the Giants. I knew that the Packers did not even want to play in the Super Bowl. They thought they had won the championship of the most important league the week before. So they didn't want to go to Los Angeles. The Kansas City Chiefs, their opponent, did very much want to play in the game for respectability as far as the AFL was concerned. But nobody thought it was going to be a contest. There were 40,000 empty seats in the Los Angeles Coliseum. The tickets were $12 a piece. It was sort of an afterthought. So nobody thought, including me and the commissioner, Pete Rozelle, or no one thought that the game would reach the magnitude that it's reached.
Well, it only changed when the Jets won the Super Bowl against the Colts, again, a New York team against the Colts, and suddenly the AFC had respectability.
Respectability, right.
Because
right.
They had been pretty much wiped
well,
out.
You could see that the game was going to be something special by that time that was a little bit more special than people had originally thought, because as I said, it was not even a sellout, the first one.
You worked with Tom Brookshire, who is right. Another great broadcaster. John Madden as well?
22 years with John Madden, 8 with Brookshire.
Now John Madden was doing color commentary. You had done color commentary before. You probably knew as much about what was going on as he did.
I don't mean
in any way to disparage John Madden, who
no.
is truly a great broadcaster.
Yes. I don't know that I knew as much about the technicalities of playing in the offensive line as John does and did. But he had that ability that he has still today to articulate something in a very limited amount of time, which you have very small amount of time as an analyst to make whatever point you want to make. I knew pretty quickly after we started to work together that we were going to fit. Because unlike other situations and other announcers I had worked with where you had hand signals or I'd tap him on the leg when I was through talking or he would give me an indication that he wanted to talk, John and I never had any kind of signal. He just knew when I was through talking. I knew when he was through talking. And we just fit together. We never interrupted each other. And I don't know why or how that magic comes together, but it did.
Well, I guess when you were with Tom Brookshire, but also with Madden, you were also drinking heavily. You say it was a lot of fun.
Not with Madden, no.
Only with Brookshire?
Right.
You were at the height of your drinking. You say also the height of your fun as an announcer.
Right.
Did you think that they went together, or is it just coincidental?
Well, I knew that Tom knew the game. I knew that I knew the game. I knew that we were comfortable with our relationship, and we had a good time off the field, out of the booth, as well as in the booth.
And I'm sure both of you hope to be nominated for Academy Awards at one point.
Well, I don't remember having those thoughts, but that's a good one.
You appeared in a film together?
Yes, two films.
Ah, because you represented broadcasting to most Americans,
well,
football broadcasting.
John Frankenheimer, who produced Black Sunday, heard us work one of the Super Bowls and said, these are the two guys I want to make my announcers as part of my movie. So Tom and I did Black Sunday, and then John and I did a movie not too long ago called The Replacements. But, yeah, we enjoyed those times.
How did you wind up covering other sports? Were you,
well, I
you played,
played
golf.
Sports. I played golf. I played basketball in college and in high school. I played baseball, obviously. And in order to get out of the football shell, so to speak, I asked the bosses at CBS if I could do golf. And after they tried me a couple of golf tournaments, then I started to cover it on a weekly basis. Same is true. I played tennis when I was growing up, and so I covered the U.S. Open for 28 years here in New York and did the French Open many times, did 2 years of the NBA. So it was just a desire on my part to do other sports as well as football.
My guest is Pat Summerall. He's written a book called Summerall, On and Off the Air. It's published by Nelson. Well, today we don't see as much of that, broadcasters covering a lot of different sports. It seems to be
more
specialty.
Well, Jim Nantz does football and golf particularly. There are some people who do it, but the seasons at that time didn't overlap as they do now. Each season has gotten longer as they try to generate more funds and more money. So it's hard to do, let's say, basketball and football at the same time. There are people who do it, but not in the way that I did it. because the seasons overlap and you just can't do both.
What other ways has the broadcasting business changed over the years?
Oh, I think when I started, there was no instant replay. That's been a big change. The mobility of the equipment. You had a stationary camera when I first started to do television. You had maybe five cameras, and they couldn't move. They just couldn't. They were too heavy. Now it's become much more mobile. The statistical part of the way you keep up with what's going on the field has become so much more sophisticated.
In fact, after a complicated play, we get to see six or seven camera angles
because
sometimes you can't tell what happened by just looking at one shot.
Well, the officials replay. If the coach challenges what happened and they replay it and replay it and replay it, then those facilities and those kind of things didn't happen when I started in the business. I think the mobility and the technical improvements have changed much more than the broadcasting of the event itself.
But it's also made it a lot more expensive.
Right.
And now ABC Sports, once one of the proudest sports broadcasting entities possible, is no longer.
No longer exists.
Yeah. So is it because it's just so expensive to do sports?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons ABC got out of the business is because they were losing money on the amount of money that they had to spend for the rights to the NFL. And the last 5 or 6 years particularly, the ratings have been going down and the amount that they can charge the advertisers has decreased. So it was time to get out.
You no longer are doing network broadcasting.
Right.
You're covering the Cowboys?
Some of their pregame shows and some inserts during halftime and things like that.
Would you want to be doing back?
If somebody asked me, I'm happy with my life, but if somebody asked me to go back and broadcast, I think I would do it.
What happened? I mean, you obviously still know the game.
Well, I think one thing that happened is I had to have a liver transplant. Mm-hmm. And so I was
out of
action.
They kept you out for a while.
Kept me out. My health started to deteriorate, so I just wasn't available. Now my health is good. And I'm ready to go back, but I haven't been asked yet.
The Cowboys are a good fit because you've known Bill Parcells for a while.
Right, and I live there.
You live in Dallas.
Yeah.
What happens after a liver transplant? Do you have to make adjustments in your life?
Well, I still have to take a lot of medicine.
To keep your body from rejecting
anti-rejection medicines and other things that happen during the transplant. My stamina is not quite what it was yet, but it's pretty doggone good, and I feel good. It's amazing how successful the operation was. I know in every case they don't have that degree of success that I have, but I feel terrific.
And you have become a speaker for organ transplants.
And God is working, got some jobs for me to do, too.
Does it feel odd suddenly being so open about your life after all these years of being somebody who people only knew as that face in the broadcast booth?
I guess it does. the most difficult person, I think, to be honest with is yourself. And I think in being honest with yourself, it's sort of a gratifying feeling to say, hey, everything that's in that book is the truth. Everything I say is the truth. The only thing I got better at when I was drinking was lying. And I'm not very proud of that. But now life is so much more simple, and everything has turned out to be just 100% better.
And I'm sure your daughter is a lot happier.
Yeah,
as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're much closer.
So I understand that thing about lying. Once you start getting caught up in lies, then it gets more and more complicated. It snowballs.
Right.
And so you've just simplified your life these days.
Well, if everything's the truth, you don't have to worry about what you said.
What about all your former colleagues, whether the former players and mm-hmm. the other broadcasters? Have you gotten any feedback from them?
Well, the book just comes out today, so no, I haven't gotten any feedback. But one of the things I waited so long to write a book for, one of the reasons I waited so long, was I wanted to wait until I had something of a positive nature to say. I didn't want to embarrass myself or any of my former working partners or anybody that I played football with or played golf with or anybody else. I wanted to wait until I felt I had something to say that might help somebody.
And Pat Summerall has told the story of being a place kicker for the legendary New York Giants in the late 50s and 60s, and then becoming a mainstay of CBS sports broadcasting for 32 years, covering football, also golf, including the Masters, the U.S. Open Tennis Championship, the NBA, five heavyweight championship fights. At the same time, he also served as host of CBS's four-hour news program that aired six mornings a week. He's written a book called Summerall, On and Off the Air, and it is published by Nelson Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last year, Sunday Night Football beat out both American Idol and the Academy Awards as the country's most popular TV broadcast. But whether you're a season ticket holder or someone who watches the game from your couch, you probably only have an inkling of most of the things that go on off the field. Nicholas Davidoff, however, knew enough about football to accept Jets head coach Rex Ryan's invitation to spend the 2011 season with the team. In his new book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football, Mr. Davidoff reveals a side of football few see, including practices, strategy meetings, and intimate profiles of the Jets' most talked-about players. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased it has brought Nicholas Davidoff back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Now, previous books were largely about baseball. Had you always wanted to write about football?
No. I guess I was, when I began to think about this book, I thought about it in terms of what I saw, or really what I didn't see on a television screen. It just seemed like an amazing thing to me that the most popular thing in America was entirely based on plans and ideas and close to 350 days of preparation that nobody sees.
Quite different than baseball, where there is some planning, but there aren't all these secret strategy meetings, are there?
Right. The secret things in baseball are signs, and most of the signs you pretty much figure out what happened, whereas in football, these coaches standing on the sidelines, you watch them, and it looks like they're holding a bistro menu in front of their face, you know, because they're afraid of opposition lip-reading. And I always just wondered what was on that menu and how did it come to be?
Now, the Huffington Post reports that President Obama bought your book just this past Saturday. Considering the way the Jets have been playing the last few years, it can't be because he's looking for a winning formula.
I know. When this happened, I thought of the Paul Simon line, you know, when he's singing, "I got the presidential seal." I just hope it gives him some pleasure. But I also was mindful that it's a trying time for him and that politics and football are alike in the sense that, you know, you're up, you're down. And I guess I thought that football to me really is more about failure than anything else. There are 32 teams in the NFL. Only one can win. And one of the most signal aspects, I think, of my experience with one of those teams was that when a team wins, they just go on to the next. They don't even really think about it. And when they lose, it's devastating. Nobody can sleep. You walk into the facility on a Monday morning, and it's the picture of depression. It's like a storm has happened, and they're overturned garbage cans and, I don't know, broken glass. And just every image you have of just something that has been wrecked. These people have put everything they have into something, and they've spent all their time to the exclusion of everything else. They don't see their children. They don't see their families. And they come in on Monday morning, and they've had this enormous public failure. And to me, professional football is really what you do with failure and how you overcome it.
Well, the 2011 season for the Jets was not a great one, but nothing like the last two. And I was wondering if you wish you had waited to be invited to witness last season or this season, because there would be so many more juicy stories.
For me, it wasn't, I guess I felt very privileged to be there at that time only because everybody told me that what I saw was a representative season, an emblematic season. You know, they finished 8-8, but I wasn't really in it for any. The general manager, Mike Tannenbaum, told me at the beginning of the year, he said, anything can happen, you know, and then he mentioned some players and he said, if this person gets hurt, you know, we could go 3-13 or something. And to me, those were never my concerns because I was much more interested in what the public doesn't see. I was interested in a group of people, which were the coaches, working together in this, you know, rarefied, closed-off place on something to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, they're working. I mean, it's like a bunch of surgeons or if you wanted to write a book about the Manhattan Project or something like that. I just like the idea of a group of people who are committed in a stupefyingly committed to something and working together all the time. So for me, it was always going to be an office story.
Well, you write that you wouldn't call yourself an expert in football. So how did Rex Ryan come to approach you about spending a year with the Jets?
I wouldn't quite, I mean, he eventually invited me, but I guess it began, I heard him on the radio. I was thinking about what my next book would be, and I write pieces for the magazines that I write for about various subjects as I see whether they'll sustain me across the life of a book. And I tried I had various political ideas, and then I heard Rex Ryan talking on the radio, and I just thought instantly that this was a special person, or as he would say, a special dude, you know, or a unique dude. He has this way of speaking and this way of behaving that I think is entirely singular to him. And I realized that he gets a lot of press out in the world, but within that more closed facility atmosphere, he is a beloved, extremely charismatic person. And, you know, so I wrote this piece about him anyway for the New York Times Magazine, and the piece was a profile of Rex, but what really drew me to football then were all the people who were working for him.
Well, you say that he is unique in the way he talks, different from his brother, Rob Ryan, the defensive coordinator for the New Orleans Saints, or their father, the legendary coach, Buddy Ryan?
I think Buddy Ryan was a defensive genius. Everybody says that.
And they call Rex a defensive genius, and his brother is a defensive coordinator for the Saints.
Right. They all really, really understand defensive football. I think what separates Rex from the other two, and Rob is much more this way than he is Buddy's way, but I would think what separates Rex is that he is a really humane person. I came to think of him as someone who had almost what I thought of as a football metabolism. You have to understand that in an NFL facility, somebody like Rex Ryan is responsible for close to 100 people. And his interactions with those people seem to me very much to replicate almost the pace and the pattern of football, which is a Twitter pace. You know, it stops and it starts. And Rex has these 82-second interactions all day long. And he's a master in these moments at getting people to reveal something of themselves that then relates in some sort of strange way that only Rex can really extract to football. And so whereas most defensive teams are, you know, every person, there's a scheme and every person on the team who's starting has a role within the scheme. For Rex, the scheme is much looser. It's more flexible. It's elastic. And Rex, as he comes to learn about the people who play for him, even the worst players on his roster, he'll find what's special about them and he'll integrate them into the scheme in a unique way. And that's what makes him a great coach.
And you say that he is so deeply lovable that people would forgive him for almost anything. Now, he invited you to do this right after there was a little scandal on YouTube involving foot fetishes. He said it was a personal matter. Do you think that he wanted to clear up his image? Is that one of the reasons he invited you to follow him around?
I don't think so. I think if it had been up to Rex, I think that was more probably a public relations decision that was not in his hands. Rex would have loved to talk about it. I mean, around the facility, everybody teases him about it, and he's human, and he's got very much his own distinct personality. And I think he would always say, when people would tease him about it, he'd say, yeah, I'm the only guy in the world who gets into a sex scandal with his wife. I mean, he's been married for more than 25 years, you know. I mean, he's just...
Did he give you any guidelines?
No.
Were there any subjects that were off limits?
You know, my only guideline, I could go anywhere and do anything. You have to make a choice. In football, the offense and the defense are really like separate states within the same country, and states that are pretty rivalrous and don't have much to do with one another. And since everybody knows a little bit about touchdowns, I thought I would be more interested in writing about defense, especially because the Jets have this very original and creative defense. So I spent all of my time with the Jets defensive coaches, except I began, just for balance, I began the day in the quarterbacks meeting with the four quarterbacks and the two coaches.
My guest is Nicholas Davidoff, Dawidoff. His latest book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. What does Collision Low Crossers mean?
Well, see, that's one of the things I like about football is that it has... In my first book, I wrote about intelligence officers, and football seemed to me a little the same way, that these are people who are engaged in this very public endeavor, but they're doing it in private, and they even have their own secret language. And Collision Low Crossers is a defensive term. It means, essentially, that a defensive player can hit and knock off his pass route any receiver within 5 yards in the line of scrimmage. After 5 yards, it's a penalty. But I think what I especially liked about the term is that expresses the essential calamity of what goes on out there in a football game. You know, there's always somebody out there who's waiting to ruin your life. And I like that football has its own language. I like also that football is full of risk and try so hard to be predictable that these people are giving over their lives to control something that is inherently uncontrollable.
And you write that you look forward to watching the people who, quote, attempt to impose order on a significantly unstable pursuit. How much does Rex Ryan think he can control things in a game when you have 22 players out on the field and all sorts of possibilities that nobody could predict?
Well, one of the things that the coach has told me is that there's when you have a given when you call a given play, only 10% of the time do all 11 people do what they're supposed to do as it's been diagrammed. Yet, and so it seems almost delusional that you can expect to control the pursuit. On the other hand, you can always try for 11%.
Well, you say that Rex Ryan is someone who seemed to think he could overcome the randomness with conviction, as though his wanting something badly enough meant that he could will it into being. Well, why hasn't it worked out that way? How does he explain the fact that the Jets have had some pretty bad seasons recently?
I don't think that Rex would publicly want to explain why, but if you just forced him to tell you the truth, the way that the NFL rules now, especially given national and NFL now concern following the national concern about concussion, means that the offense has a distinct advantage, and the position that has the greatest advantage is quarterback. So if you have a really good quarterback, you're in a very good position in the NFL if you can keep him healthy, like a Tom Brady or a Drew Brees or a Peyton Manning. But if you have a young quarterback who is inconsistent, like a Mark Sanchez or a Geno Smith, your life is going to be much more difficult.
Well, the Jets put a lot of money into Mark Sanchez and also Darrell Revis the year that you were covering them. It cost a quarter of the Jets' salary cap in forced budget. But why did that hurt them? A lot of teams have star players who get big money.
Well, Darrell Revis is possibly the best defensive player of his time. But since the rules of the sport right now are so much canted toward offense, you better have star players who are offensive players. And the fact is that Mark Sanchez, while they hoped he would be a star, he really is in certain ways the representative NFL player, which is to say, so much money goes into research and development. So much, I mean, the algorithms, the portfolios, the dossiers that these scouts are, you know, compiling on various players, and then they draft them and they nurture them. And even in Mark Sanchez's fourth year, they still had no idea how good he was. You just can't tell.
They kept on predicting every year, well, this is the year he's going to have figured it out. He's been talking to the coaches, and he knows all sorts of things that he didn't know before. And then he'd go out there and throw more interceptions than is acceptable.
More interceptions in crucial moments. It was, and, you know, interceptions and turnovers, those are the things that just completely demoralize a team. I don't know. Sanchez has everything going for him that you'd want in a quarterback. He's smart. He's athletically gifted. He's hardworking. I mean, during his breaks during practice, he'd be running wind sprints. You know, if he wasn't getting along with a player, he'd make it a point then to, during practice, to go off and spend special time with him. I mean, it's just one of those things about football, and I think it's one of the reasons we like it. It's so unpredictable.
And then last season, they traded for Tim Tebow when almost every football expert thought it was a big mistake. That was after you covered the team. But I wondered whether this had as much to do with Woody Johnson, the Jets owner, liking Tim Tebow's politics. Didn't Johnson say that he felt it was more important for Mitt Romney to win the presidency than for the Jets to win the Super Bowl, which may have been his feeling, but it seems to me rather indiscreet considering the fact that the Jets probably have a fair number of Democrats who root for them?
You know, I think that what Tebow really boiled down to is that with every big football decision, and I watched a lot of them happen, with every big football decision, they are understandable why the decision is made. And looking back, you can see why it failed because all the information for failure was there too. But it's just, I think that's why I like to think about sort of football and politics in the same way. The war room and either the draft room or the game planning room, these are similar, highly charged little spaces where people are working very hard and thinking very hard about decisions with huge public implications, and sometimes those decisions go very, very wrong. I think there's still people with the Jets who don't quite understand why Tebow went so awry, because the year before Tebow, they had a quarterback who was known as the change of pace quarterback for Sanchez, a running quarterback who they'd bring on occasion named Brad Smith.
Who they let go.
You know, he was an expensive free agent. And they brought Tebow in, and they thought he'd fulfill that role, and he wasn't the analog.
And he hasn't been the analog for anybody. In fact, now he's out of football.
It's just amazing that somebody who Rex Ryan considered, at least in 2011, possibly the greatest college player there ever was, could be such a bust in the NFL.
My guest is Nicholas Davidoff. His latest book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football, published by Little Brown. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Nicholas Davidoff, who is the author of four previous critically acclaimed books, including the best-selling The Catcher Was a Spy and The Crowd Sounds Happy. His latest is Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. It's published by Little Brown. Does the football season never end for the coaches?
Never ends. The day if a team doesn't do well, doesn't make the playoffs, then in that period between as other teams are competing in the playoffs, the coaches come in and they're already starting to work on the following year's draft. They're preparing for what's called the NFL Combine, which is the annual sort of talent show of college players that goes on in Indianapolis. And they're also waiting to see if they're fired.
And sometimes they are.
Right.
Many of the Jets coaches who were there when you wrote this book are no longer with the team.
But some of them in optimistic ways. I mean, Rex Ryan really had two ambitions. One of them everybody knows about because he guaranteed a Super Bowl during his tenure, which so far hasn't happened. But the other was that his coaching staff, that people would be elevated either to become offensive or defensive coordinators of other teams or head coaches. And so many of the people who were on the staff when I was there are now spread out all across the country running the Kansas City Chiefs defense and all the way through. And so for me, when I look now at the map of the United States, I see these little flares in Chicago and Dallas and Kansas City and St. Louis, and they're all football coaches.
On the other hand, when they're let go, we're told that the new person who's coming in is going to correct all the problems. That's what happened with the offensive coordinator this year because everybody was so disillusioned with last year's. And, of course, isn't it really just the talent on the team? How much of it is the coaches?
I think that the Jets coaches, the defensive coordinator Mike Patton, who is the defensive coordinator of the Jets previously and now he's the defensive coordinator for the Buffalo Bills, I think that he would say that nothing can overcome talent, that no coach should be so arrogant as to think that, you know, that any kind of game plan could overcome really good talent. But there's also a fair amount of luck in football, too.
And there's also the matter of injuries. And recently we've been hearing an awful lot about the effect of head injuries, which the NFL denied was a problem. Concussions were a problem for a long time. And they enlisted, in fact, the Jets doctor way before you got involved in this, to prove that it wasn't that concussions were not a serious problem. He wasn't a neurologist.
That whole episode in the NFL is shameful. I never understand why, when something is in your best interest, health is in the NFL's best interests, why they wouldn't have taken a more active role in thinking hard about something which is the greatest threat to the game.
So did they think about it now? Was that something that they discussed?
You wouldn't find it discussed in an NFL facility, and I think that's because most football players are very young, and a lot of them, of course, think they're going to live forever. But also, I think it is so difficult to be in the NFL and then to stay in the NFL. There's the expression for somebody who's been cut from a team is that he's on the street. And I think it really beautifully expresses the divide between the facility wall and being within. And I think that also it's true that you can't play on an NFL team if everybody gets hurt, but nobody thinks they're going to get hurt. If you're going out there thinking you're going to get hurt, you won't be an effective football player.
Well, I've always wondered about the running backs and the wide receivers because they are being hit constantly, and they usually have shorter careers.
I think, especially running backs. Oh. Yeah, I think that there's one of the things that people talk about is called a gladiator complex, that people just don't believe it's going to be them.
Now, you mentioned the combines, that they're kind of auditions for all of the various scouts, kind of a screen test, you say, a beauty pageant, and a strongman contest at a football county fair. How much do they really determine what players wind up being drafted in what order?
It's like anything else in these sorts of businesses. There's just a certain kind of momentum, and it's a strange momentum that can develop, and the combine is one of the places where momentum can begin. I also think of the combine as just a wonderful thing to see because it's the NFL convention, except for the Super Bowl. So it was, for me, just a lot of fun to watch all these people sort of mixing it up and Rex Ryan right at this vortex.
Well, they often get it wrong. For example, the most effective quarterback in football these days was not drafted number one or even, I think, in the top 10 of his season.
He was drafted in the low sixth round, and that was just – when you're drafted in the sixth round, you could just as easily be a free agent. It's Tom Brady, I think we're talking about.
So How much do they actually know? I'm assuming that most of the decisions are based on their college careers, but that is really uneven. Unless they play for one of the best teams in the country, you have no idea whether their statistics are because they were playing against inferior defenses or whether they were really great.
Well, I wrote a book about my grandfather, who was a Harvard economist who was known as the Harvard professor who knew the most. And what all of the very smart people who were his friends used to tell me as I was thinking about that book was, the thing that people who know the most know best is how little they know. And football people, I guarantee it, know the most about how the people they're thinking about drafting, and it's still such an enigma.
Although there are certain scouts, head scouts, and general managers who draft very well year after year after year. So what were the Jets looking for in the 2011 combine?
Well, the Jets drafted extremely well in 2011. They drafted Muhammad Wilkerson in the first round. They got him at
number
30. He's
going to be a Pro Bowler this year.
He's going to be a Pro Bowl defensive lineman. They drafted Bilal Powell, who's a starting running back. They drafted Greg McElroy in the seventh round, and he played for them and made the team.
No longer,
but he's he was still, for that low a draft choice, he was still something. Kenrick Ellis has done pretty well. He's still a viable defensive lineman. It's tough. I mean, if you run down some of the best talent evaluators in the business, like Bill Belichick, they miss all the time. It is just a business that is fraught with uncertainty. And again, I think that's really why people like it so much. That because of all that uncertainty, it's just like politics. It allows a certain amount of speculation from those of us who are just sitting out there, and it's fun for us.
Now, there was a lockout the year that you covered the Jets. How did that affect the draft and preparation?
It didn't affect the preparation at all. The only thing it affected was that the players weren't there for a period of time in the offseason.
Were they expected to come in really good shape?
Nobody knew. The day that the players came back, everybody was looking them over to see, that guy been drinking too much beer. Is he looking a little portly or something like that? I mean, but for me, it was actually pretty serendipitous because it meant I got to spend all the more time with my main characters, who is this group of coaches, and I got to know them better, and I could have conversations with them about things that weren't related to football since we would talk about Simon and Garfunkel.
Do they get along,
the coaches?
It's absolutely, because they all have their little fiefdoms.
I think that it really is, more than most places I've ever been, a pretty collective endeavor. It is military in the sense that it's top-down or it has that kind of stratification, but you have to get along. Now, when a team starts losing, every team in the NFL, when they start losing, that's the difficult time. I remember the Jets began my year and they were 2-0. We were out on the practice field and it was giddy with excitement and good feeling. And the Jets quarterback coach that year was Matt Kavanaugh, who was a former longtime NFL player, and he came over to me and he looked at me and he said, "This isn't the NFL that you're seeing. It's only when you're losing that you really see the NFL, because it's just like, it's just loss determines how well you will win."
And you got to see the NFL, the real NFL, very soon afterward.
I did. I saw a regressing quarterback for the offense, and I saw a defense that lost its two smartest, most essential players. Aside from Revis, a safety, Jim Leonard, who is known as the quarterback of the defense, he was hurt when they were on a winning streak and they lost the last three games after he was hurt. And Brian Thomas, the outside linebacker, who set the edge and did all of this, the really sort of esoteric little football responsibilities were his that make a team win or not.
They allowed Jim Leonard to leave as well after an injury. He's done fairly well. Couldn't they have tried to retain him if he was so smart? He sounds to me like somebody's going to wind up being a coach in the future.
Probably will be. I mean, he gave me a document once that was 120 pages long, and it was basically a smart NFL safety's notes to self. It was his sort of treatise on the Rex Ryan defense, and it was fascinating to read. The reason that I think, he's pretty slow by NFL standards, and that was his second leg injury. So I think that's why they let him go. But I'll tell you, Mike Pettine, his old defensive coordinator with the Jets, now in Buffalo, telling me all the time that Jimmy Leonard is saving his season as it is.
My guess is Nicholas Davidoff, Davidoff. His latest book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. It is published by Little Brown. You found that NFL coaches watch more football on film than they do live on the field. What are they looking for when they're looking at the film? Are they looking for what worked or what went wrong?
It took me a while to figure it out because obviously there's no sound, and I didn't speak the language. I didn't know what things like collision low crossers meant. So for, you know, coaches have two views. They have the end zone view, and then they've got a view from the 50-yard line that's above. And what they're doing is they are evaluating every single player's performance in every single play. And this may require looking at him two or three times, moving the film back and forth. And then they grade them. And sometimes the grades come with comments, and the comments are fierce. They're often little screeds, especially if something goes badly, because really what they're doing is, again, with the margin so tight between success and failure, what they're really doing is they're just trying to move people a little better, and they think that the way to do it is with that old goad, which is criticism. And that's why Rex Ryan's real mantra is, you have to have skin like an armadillo. It's a blunt force trauma world. And yet, that's one of the things that makes Rex so appealing to players is, even though he says this, the most sensitive players on the team are the ones he's most protective of.
I wonder what happens when the coaches watch film and see a penalty not called or a penalty called that they feel shouldn't have been called.
Even when they're watching film from 4 years previous and it's a penalty that was called that shouldn't have been called, their heads are going to explode. They just can't believe it. I mean, you know, it was so clear to me always that they just weren't over it.
You write that Mike Pettine, the defensive coordinator, frequently made up his own expressions to the point where you became an amateur Pettine scholar. What kinds of expressions did he make up? Did the other coaches know what he was talking about?
Oh, they did, because these expressions, you know, would be used by Pettine as they were watching film, and it's like anything else. You know, if you go to Bangkok, if you hear someone speaking Thai long enough, you'll speak Thai too. So soon all the other coaches were speaking Pettine's version of Thai. And so, yeah, there's a whole glossary of Pettine terms in the book.
One of the coaches, Mike Smith, who is known as Smitty, started as an intern, went on to work as an outside linebacker coach before he left to work in college football in the middle of the season. Is that unusual to leave in the middle of the season?
He didn't leave in the middle of the season. He was offered a job in the middle of the season, which isn't unusual because once teams finish, like if a college team finishes, it may hire a new coach, and then he immediately wants to fill his staff. So in the middle of the Jets season, Smitty was getting coaching offers, and he was trying to decide what to do because it was his college coach who was offering him a job. And Mike Smith is a very, very loyal and endearing person. He was someone who played as a Baltimore Raven for Rex Ryan and Mike Pettine, and then he had a career-ending injury. And they knew that Smitty would become a really, really good coach because players who don't become good coaches are players who are still living in their playing past. Once Smitty's career was, you know, so abruptly truncated, he immediately was all about other people. And that's really what a coach amounts to. It's someone who is curious and engaged in the lives of other people, who's compassionate and empathetic. I know these are football coaches and these are surprising words to use, but it's really true. If your whole life can be devoted to improving someone else's life, that's really a coach.
So he gave up the idea of becoming a college coach. Is he still with the Jets?
After the season ended, he spent another year with the Jets last year. And this year, he and his wife were about to have their first child, and he was offered the defensive coordinator job at Texas Tech. So he's now living, and he grew up in Lubbock, so he was back out in Lubbock.
Locker room politics have been in the news recently. You've even written about the Miami Dolphins bullying controversy for the New Yorker's website. Did you witness bullying in the locker room, in the Jets locker room?
No, but I witnessed nothing like what is supposed to have happened in Miami, and certainly nobody who I've talked to subsequently with the Jets ever saw anything like it.
But the Miami players said, oh, this is life in the NFL. This is what every locker room is like.
That's not what every locker room is like. But what every locker room is like is this. I mean, I think my experiences are a pretty good example. I mean, I was different. The NFL is taking you can think of the huddle as America, a little bit of everyone, and then you have to collect all of these disparate people into a sense of unified purpose. And the way you do it, in part, is with teasing. It's just like high school or just like any other office, per se. But every one of us since high school can tell the difference between teasing that is affectionate and inclusive and something that is meant to express an unpleasant power dynamic that is meant to hurt. And there were a couple occasions when I saw people saying things that were meant to hurt other people, but nothing on the scale of what went on in Miami.
Well, there are a lot of pranks you describe, including the super gluing the lid on the communal peanut butter jar, which Rex Ryan had been eating out of, and they filmed him trying to open it. This sounds like high school stuff.
There wasn't that much of that stuff, but when it happened, I mean, it was funny. I mean, I have to say that a lot of the pranks that were played around the facility just things like that just make people like coming to work a little more. Their life is working so hard. Some of them were trying. The offensive coordinator, Brian Schottenheimer, by the end of the season had all but eliminated sleep. If he was sleeping 3 hours a night, I wouldn't believe it. They are working so hard. So something which, if you are devoting all of your life to the exclusion of everything else, to be in this place that has no windows, where your whole life is football, anything that makes it a little bit more fun is better. And that's Rex's coaching philosophy, too. Practicing and coaching football involves a tremendous amount of repetition, and it is tedious. In any way that you can make the repetition not seem repetitious, which this is one of Rex's real areas of expertise, that's a valuable thing in a football coach.
Well, you mentioned earlier that there's always this feeling, well, next week we will do better after a loss. But I imagine there comes a time during a losing season of the sort that the Jets went through last year, perhaps will be going through from now on, where people understand that they're not going to win many games, if any. So what happens then? Did people just give up, or they start playing for the next contract?
I don't doubt your premise, but, you know, I never saw that. I think that the way the NFL people that I knew think of it is they think of it in terms of their resume. Everything that they put on film is going to be watched by the other 31 teams around the league. So no matter how awry your season's going, you still have the opportunity to display what you're about to another team. And often the way that NFL talent evaluators work is they will look at a bad team's film from the end of the season, and they'll see who's still displaying effort and skill in exactly the circumstances you describe.
And the pundits have no idea that the New York Times predicted the Jets would win yesterday. They lost 23-3 to the Dolphins and looked pretty awful in the process.
They did. I think the problem yesterday was similar to the problems throughout 2011, which is the Jets have a really, really good defense. But if your defense spends too much time on the field, and it's like they get tired. You have a certain amount of retardant, and it eventually gives way to the burn.
So that's what happened, and that's why the Dolphins at the end looked like an offensive juggernaut. I mean, yeah, they were just marching across down the field.
Only at the end, but if you look at the time of possession for the game, I think the Jets' problems this year are fairly similar to the problems in 2011. It's just really hard to win without an extremely competent quarterback.
PBS reports that there have been 101 concussions in the NFL in this season. Did the Jets suffer many concussions the year you were there?
Not too many. I remember during one game, one of the players was thought to have suffered a concussion, and I was surprised. I mean, this is, I guess, you know, the NFL's come a long way in terms of health. Even the younger players would say that when they were in college, if you went into the training room, it was a sign of weakness. And now if you go into the training room, it's considered something professional because you're supposed to take care of your career and you're supposed to serve the team as well as possible. So it's considered shrewd. And I remember that when one of the players was thought to have had a concussion during a game, from the general manager sitting up in the box, Mike Tannenbaum, immediately called his parents. You know, I think he called his girlfriend. You know, I mean, there was a certain, you know, familial concern that always really impressed me. That was one of the things I really hadn't expected about football. I always assumed that the people who played professional football did so, well, because they were athletically suited to it, and also because they liked something that was really, really aggressive. More than a surprising number of the players, I would say, told me that the real appeal of football to them, many, many NFL players grew up under straitened circumstances. They grew up in single-family homes. Some of them were even orphans. A lot of them grew up in real poverty. And what a lot of them would say is that football was an opportunity to have some of the things a little later in life that they lacked as children, that there was a surrogate familial atmosphere.
Coaches and former players often tell you that you don't see the game that they see, and that's not just in football. I've had baseball players tell me the same thing. So now that you've gone through this, do you see something different when you're watching a game on television?
I'm sure I do see something different. I can see a lot more, but I really miss those coaching angles, you know, sitting in that room, looking at it from, I mean, the coaching film is a different kind of film, and looking at it from that privileged angle with those seven narrators sitting around that long table with their energy drinks talking about it all, you see then, I mean, the players on a Monday morning will come into the cafeteria at breakfast, and they'll ask the coaches how the film looked. Sometimes even the players have no idea how well they played. It's such an intricately choreographed sport. It is so difficult to really measure what happened in any given play. It's just it's almost impossible to think that any of us who are watching it are really seeing it. And that's one of the things that I thought was most beautiful about football. Here's the most popular entertainment in America, something that gives people tremendous pleasure. We're sitting there watching it every Sunday on the screen, right? And it's a completely different game that's actually happening. To me, it's a fascinating dichotomy.
Nicholas Davidoff's book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football, has gotten rave reviews from people like Thomas Powers, who called it one of the best books ever written about sports, from Frank DeFord, and many others. And now President Obama has bought a copy. It's called Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. Little Brown is the publisher. I'm wondering whether John Boehner will now buy a copy once he's heard that Obama's bought his. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It was so nice to be here again. Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in today for Leonard Lopate. Nearly 100 million people will be watching when the New England Patriots take on the Seattle Seahawks in Super Bowl 49. Now, for many of the players, getting a chance to compete in that game of games will be a dream come true, a reward for a lifetime of training their bodies and developing their skills. But what happens to these athletes when they become too old or too injured to continue playing? George Kuntz, who was a linebacker with the Green Bay Packers when they won the 1997 Super Bowl, knows firsthand the challenge of starting over after a football career ends. And it's among the topics he addresses in Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL, which he co-wrote with James A. Holstein and Richard S. Jones, both sociology professors at Marquette University. It's published by the NYU Press. And I'm so happy it brings him to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hello, George.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Now, you're going to be in Phoenix for the Super Bowl's media week. Is that the plan?
Yes, I'm going to be in Phoenix from Wednesday through Saturday. I'm also going to have a chance to have some meetings because I work at Marion University over in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And we're going to be meeting with potential donors because a lot of the donors and alums of Marion University kind of snowbird towards either Florida or the Phoenix area.
And where is Marion located?
That's... Marion is in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Probably about
an hour
north of Milwaukee.
Okay, that's what I wanted. I wanted to get the coordinates. So it's close to Milwaukee. So this is something, it's natural for you as a former Packer to have wound up at Marion University. What is your job at the university?
I'm vice president for advancement. My position is to raise money for the institution and also to have a chance to work with athletics. We're a Division III program, and athletics report to me as well. So I have a really good job. I'm loving my job because 51% of the students at Marion are coming from low-income families or they're first in their families to go to college. And I can kind of relate to that because if it wasn't for a football scholarship, I would have never had a chance to go to college myself. So.
Sure. Now, what goes on during media week? Is that just a total zoo?
Complete zoo. Have a lot of interviews, a lot of socializing. I get a chance to go to Radio Row.
And socializing is such a good euphemism that covers so many activities, but I won't get more specific about that. Will you get to see the game as well? Are you going to actually get to see the game?
No. I'm going to fly back. I'm going to fly back to cold Wisconsin on Saturday afternoon.
Oh, that's so you'll watch it at home.
Yes.
Okay, just like the rest of us. Now, you played for the Seahawks, too, for a season after your career at Green Bay came to an end. So are you going to be rooting for the Seahawks? Are you with the Seahawks on this? Or?
Yes, I was kind of torn in the during the NFC Championship.
That's right, because they were playing each other.
Yeah, I was very, very fortunate. I was able to play for the Packers for 8 years, and our longtime coach, a guy by the name of Coach Mike Holmgren, went to the Seattle Seahawks, and he was able to bring me over. And so I had a chance to see what it was like to play in a metropolitan city because, you know, Green Bay is the smallest city of all professional franchises, whether it's in Major League Baseball, hockey, NBA, or NFL. So.
And Mike Holmgren actually came later to my hometown, Cleveland, to run the Cleveland Browns organization. But we'll talk about that later because I have some questions about what exactly is going on in Cleveland. The game a lot of stuff has come up in recent days about the game. Are you following Deflategate, this whole controversy about the deflated footballs?
A little bit, you know, but tell me about that.
Well, I wanted you. You're the expert. Okay. I've never played in the NFL. Well, they're saying that the Patriots are deflating the footballs to make it a little bit easier for them. I guess they're easier to catch and easier to kick. Is that true, first of all? Is that the case?
Easier to throw.
Is it easier to do all that stuff?
I would assume so, but...
but well, you've actually touched a football in an NFL game. I've never done that.
Right, but also, too, the weather is a little colder up there as well, so maybe that was the reason why the air kind of went out of the football.
I see. So you're not attributing any kind of nefarious motives to Bill Belichick, because he would never be involved in tipping the scales.
No, not at all. There's
not a chance.
Not a chance.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lofay at WNYC and WNYC.org, and I am talking to George Koontz, who was a linebacker with the Green Bay Packers when they won the 1997 Super Bowl. He also played for the Seattle Seahawks, and he has written a new book with a couple of sociology professors called Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL. Now, you and your co-authors spoke with hundreds of former players for this book. Were they all of a man in saying that the Super Bowl is the greatest experience? Is that the thing that you live for in football? Was there unanimity on that?
Oh, most definitely. You know, growing up in Eastern North Carolina, my mom got me involved in youth football. She got me involved. It was called Pop Warner.
Mm-hmm.
She got me involved,
sure,
when I was about 9 years old, and I had aspirations of playing on the largest stage in America, and that was the Super Bowl, and I was very, very fortunate to go to Super Bowl 31 and 32.
Mm-hmm.
We won 31. We lost Super Bowl 32, but that's okay.
The Denver Broncos.
Yeah, we got the ring. The Denver Broncos was very, very, they was a very, very good team, and they're very, very deserving of the Super Bowl that they beat us. But had a great run. Had an awesome opportunity to go to college on a football scholarship and get a college degree. So football's been great for me.
What was the Super Bowl experience like as a player to step out on that field? Is it just a completely different experience in terms of adrenaline and nervous energy and all that?
Right. It was. I would say it was probably about 10 times as high as a playoff game, and
wow,
more so than a regular season game. Because you know that if you win this game, you can go down in history.
Right.
And you want to be on the right side of history.
And, we all do.
Right. And I tell you what, that was just amazing how intense, especially the beginning of the football game, how intense it was.
Right. And mm-hmm. And do you still wear the ring? Do you ever
I
wear
do.
The, you do?
I do. I don't have it on today.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing.
Normally, Andy, I wear it when I whenever I have, I think the rule of thumb is you wear it when you have on a tuxedo.
Another disappointment today that you did not show up in a tuxedo, but
right,
it's okay. This is public radio. You don't have to be fancy for
all
us.
Right.
We often read in the media about ex-football players who are battling a lot of stuff.
Right.
I mean, unemployment, substance abuse. But you have had a really great post-career phase in your life. You're an author. You, as you mentioned, you work at Marion University, VP of Advancement there. You also have a PhD from Marquette.
Yes.
What's your PhD in?
Well, I'm out of sociology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you were working with these sociology professors, you were speaking the same language.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, that's great. Are you the exception to the rule, or has the press exaggerated the problems? Because the stereotype is the troubled former NFL player. Is that a stereotype, or how much truth is there to that?
Well, the majority of the football players, I think it's a combination of both. I think there are some smart, deserving, disciplined, young men, good-looking, current football players and former football players. I think there's probably about 18,000 former football players around our great nation.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, they're doing some great things. But when you hear of one of your childhood heroes, a Bernie Kosar, who had some issues with finances and,
mm-hmm,
at one point of his career, and a Warren Sapp, those type of stories kind of dominate the headlines and in the newscast and in the newspapers. But for the most part, NFL players are doing pretty good. Just that, you know, you said earlier that we talked to over 100 football players, but I think I've talked to over 1,000 during my career about their transitions. And for the most part, they're doing well.
Mm-hmm. So you think the media tends to focus on the bad news because that makes a better story.
Right. Yeah. I think so. Mm-hmm. But there are some outstanding stories out there. You look at a guy by the name of Eugene Prophet from he was from Compton, went to Yale, played football at Yale, and then went on to the New England Patriots. And he has a hedge fund, a mutual fund, over $2 billion. He has the largest mutual fund of a minority in this country. And he was a former football player, but he's smart. And there's a lot of guys that's doing extremely well. Oh, Willie Davis, for instance, mm-hmm. played for Vince Lombardi. He's probably about 80 years old right now, but he had an extraordinary career in the boardroom and for his running his businesses.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about your journey a little bit, because that's where this all begins. You were mentioning earlier when we were talking that at the age of 9, you were playing Pop Warner football, a good starting point. At that point already, did you know that your dream was to be in the NFL? Was that already ordained for you in your mind?
Most definitely. And I think if you would ask the majority of the young boys in my class at the time, what did they want to do when they grow up, I bet probably 90% of them would say that they would play in the NBA or mm-hmm. Major League Baseball or the NFL. So mm-hmm. I had dreams and aspirations to play on Sundays. Mm-hmm. But my mom stepped in very, very quickly and said, George, if you have aspirations to play on Sundays, you have a lot of work to do Monday through Friday.
That's a good mother.
Right. So she got me involved. Signed me up for tutors and different things because education and schoolwork didn't come as easily as the athletic part. Mm-hmm. So I had to work extra hard in the classroom to get by, and it worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Tell me a little bit about your recruitment to go to college.
Well, I have a very unique a story because I was pretty good in high school. I had a couple scholarship offers, but I couldn't make the grades. I didn't have the proper SAT or ACT, mm-hmm. And my GPA wasn't the highest. So I had to go to the junior college. Mm-hmm. I had to go to a junior college. And
which college was that?
It was Chowan College at the time, and mm-hmm. now it's Chowan University mm-hmm. in Murfreesboro, North Carolina. So my mom took me on a school visit, and we took a tour, and I said, Mom, I want to come. She said, are you sure you want to come to school here? I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, well, they don't give out scholarships. And so my mom said, George, I'm going to refinance my house.
Wow.
They give you the $6,500 to cover because there was a gap in between my Pell Grants and the loans that I took out, my student loans. So she said, George, I'm going to have to take out a loan. So she refinanced the house and gave me $65 to close that gap my freshman year. And I did extraordinary in the classroom. I had a very, very good freshman season. And then the next year, they gave me a football scholarship. It was the first time in the history of the school that they did that. So if it wasn't for my mom investing in me, it would have been really, really difficult for me to go to college.
I'm speaking with George Koontz Jr. about the lifelong consequences of a career in football. George has both a Super Bowl championship under his belt and a PhD in sports administration. His book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL, is published by NYU Press. We'll have more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. Well, football is in the air because we've got the Super Bowl coming up, and the gentleman who is in the studio with me today has actually been to the Super Bowl as a linebacker, George Koontz. He has written a new book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL. So, George, playing college football and passing the academic classes while you're there seems like a difficult prospect, but you've described in your book how schools and also later the NFL create what you call a bubble to protect and help football players. Can you explain to me how that bubble works? How does it play out in college?
Well, I found myself being in the bubble from 9 years old until I was 32. It didn't, Andy, it didn't take you very long to see me running around on a football field to know that I had some special talents.
Right.
And with that comes with a lot of individuals trying to help you along the way. And a lot of those individuals have a hidden agenda. But for the most part, they was just trying to help me realize my dream. And my dream was to go to college and to go on and play in the National Football League. But I was isolated. And I also came to depend on a lot of those individuals that was around me.
Mm-hmm. And, well, when you say hidden agenda, the agenda is really winning football games, right? Isn't that? That's the only agenda, really.
Right. Winning football games, because you know sport is a big business. When I was in college, it was a multi-million-dollar business, and now it's a multi-billion-dollar business. So football, a lot of coaches' careers are on the line.
And at this point now, aren't there coaches who would much prefer to coach in college than in the NFL because there's more money, more stability, the programs are bigger, it's just a bigger deal. It's eclipsed the NFL.
For the most part, well, it's close. You know, you look at Jim Harbaugh.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of him going to Michigan.
Yep, the new coach at Michigan is probably making about $8 million. He's probably making more money. The head football coach at Michigan is probably making more money than the head coach over at the New York Giants and the New York Jets.
Yeah.
So college football, college sports is big time, big, big, big business. And so I had some individuals that was around me at the time that was just trying to help me realize my dream, but also, too, they were able to make some money, too.
That's right. There was a little bit of controversy a couple of years ago, and it came to light again because this kid, Cardell Jones, who plays for the Buckeyes, the Ohio State team, terrific quarterback. He had tweeted some very disparaging comments about academics and said, you know, we're here to play football, not play school or play class or whatever he said.
Right.
And he was sort of just saying what a lot of people know to be true, which is that the players are there to play.
Right.
And they're not there to study. How do the schools enable this and enable them to get through and pass their courses in this bubble, as you call it?
Right. A lot of people would say that the academic advisors and some of the tutors and some of the professors are kind of spoon-feeding the student athletes an education. But what we have to understand is that the most important thing isn't to get a degree. Now, that's great. But I think sometimes we get education and graduating confused. Because at the end of the day, we want those student athletes to be able to get a great education, and they can go out there and earn a living and take care of their families. That's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
But all too often, we hear that a lot of players go through 4 or 5 years on a college campus and have a college degree, and they can't take care of their families, and they can't provide for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like the way you describe the bubble in your book, that a lot of the kids who are playing college football don't really have to do the same chores that the rest of us have to do in terms of the mechanics of registration and writing their checks and finding housing and all that. Who is doing that for them?
All that stuff is taken care of for you.
This is a good deal.
I know, it's a great life. You know, but there are some downsides to it as well.
Of course, because you're not ready when you have to do that in the real world.
Exactly.
Right? You've never done any of it.
A lot of the mundane things that we think is that a lot of you may take for granted. I remember moving out of my mom's house. I went into a dormitory, and the next thing you know, I'm with the Green Bay Packers, and I have a check for $25,000, and I'm like, what do I do with this? I never had a checking. I haven't had a checking account up until that point.
What did you do with that check?
Well, I asked one of my, just like so many other players, young players in the locker room, you ask one of the veteran players, what do you do? And they said, well, I'm going to take you to the bank and help you open up a checking account,
mm-hmm.
a savings account, and let's deposit that money and let's start that whole process to start trying to figure out how you can save some money after your playing days are done. Because we all know, Andy, that the average football career is only 3.5 years.
Yeah.
So you're going to be a young man when it's all over, 26.
Shorter than other professional sports, right? Because of all the contact and all the injuries.
Most definitely.
Right.
Basically, your pro NFL career is going to be shorter than your college career. And because, you know, a lot of players are going to be in college from 4 to 5 years. And the National Football League is 3.5. And I've heard some statistics that is 1.9 years or 1.8 years. So the career is very, very brief. So,
and the money is not as big as people think either.
Right. A lot of people think that you make it to the National Football League or professional sports that you have it made for the rest of your life, and that's not the case.
Right. I there's a huge difference, I guess, between the average player's salary and the median player's salary. The guy who's like right in between, right the dead center of the sport, makes about $700,000 a year. Right.
Exactly.
And that's a lot of money, of course, but it's not a lot of money if you're playing 1.8 years and then you're done.
Right.
So is there anyone in this bubble, is there anyone there to also say to these guys, hey, you know, put that money away, don't blow it on a Mercedes, whatever. Is there anyone there to offer that kind of wisdom, or is it just live for the moment and a lot of people sort of, you know, geeking you up to spend it, live large, and do all that?
Andy, I think you're exactly right. I think majority of the players think they're going to live large, and there's not a lot of reason, a lot of within that bubble, because a lot of players think that, you know, the average is 3.5 years, and I'm far from the average. I'm exceptional. I was exceptional when I was in North Carolina. I was exceptional when I was in Texas. I was the best in the state of North Carolina, best in the state of Texas. So surely I'm going to play 10 to 15 years, and I could start thinking about that at a later date for saving money. But right now, I'm going to live for the moment, and I'm going to spend as undisciplined. I'm going to be undisciplined when I go to the dealership. I'm going to be undisciplined when I go see my realtor. And next thing you know, you play 1.8 years or 3.5 years, and you don't have any money.
Are there any spending decisions you made as a kid that you – regret, that you wish you had the money back now, or were you prudent with your money?
I was pretty conservative with my money, but I didn't have to have a Corvette when I was 23 years old, but I had a cutout on my dormitory wall when I was like I was a junior in college, or I was a junior. I said, if I ever make it in the National Football League, I'm going to buy a car. I'm going to buy a Corvette. I didn't have to have that Corvette.
You just had the cutout.
Right.
That's nice. Right. Smart move.
Yes.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org, and I am talking to Super Bowl champion, I'd like to call him, George Kuntz, formerly of the Green Bay Packers and the Seattle Seahawks. He is the author of a new book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL. And I'd like to talk a little bit about your life after football. There's a problem as a football player, which you talk about in the book, of knowing when you're done with football. Because in your case, you were a star. You went to the Super Bowl with the Packers. You were picked up by the Seahawks, but then you were done with the Seahawks. And were you kind of in limbo for a couple of years, where you didn't know, do I still have a team out there who wants to pick me up, or do I feel good enough, and are my skills still good enough to play? What was that period of your life like?
That was the most difficult time in my life.
Right. Because you've defined yourself as an athlete. That's right. Really been your whole identity up to that point.
Exactly. From 9 years old to 32.
Wow.
A part of my purpose on earth, I thought, was running around on a football field. So when I was done, when the NFL left me, because I still want to play on Sundays. I want to play in the Super Bowl coming up. When football left me, there was a huge void, because there was a loss of identity, because it was a part of who I was, I thought. And so my late wife at the time said, George, we can't reinvent who you are. We have to redefine who you are. And I started on that path. I had a car wreck that I was able to walk away from. I was going through depression. And I was able to circle the wagons and get up from that, get out of that ditch, get away from that that bad wreck that I was in, and say, George, I'm going to really go about changing neighborhoods, giving students an opportunity to get an education because football is no longer a part of who I am. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very difficult to take, but I had a new life.
Did you have to get some therapy to make that happen?
I did. And also, too, I leaned heavily upon my faith. Mm-hmm. I had a pastor at the time that really took me up under his wing and helped me with the counseling and all that because I was in deep, deep depression for about 2 years, but mm-hmm. I was able to get through it.
Mm-hmm. So when you pulled through that, what was your next step to defining the new George? The old George had been the guy who loved to run around on the football field, and that was your identity. How did you arrive at the new George?
Right. First, I had to find I had to get a plan and mm-hmm. I had to try to figure out what did I want to do next. And so I said, you know what, I have to go back to school. So at about 33, 34 years old, I enrolled in a master's program at East Carolina University. And I was able to come on board at East Carolina to work in their athletic department, my alma mater. And mm-hmm. My new career was launched in athletic administration and higher education.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said in the book that after you left the NFL, you almost turned down a job offer to come back to your alma mater. What mm-hmm. made you turn it down initially or want to turn it down, and what changed your mind?
I thought it was an insult. Mm-hmm. They offered me about $36,000.
Well, this isn't the NFL, George.
I didn't have any idea what the...
Exactly.
what real life was. I didn't know what people was really making.
Right.
You know, but then I kind of...
Good thing you weren't offered a job in public radio. That's all I can say.
Okay.
That wouldn't have gone well. I can assure you. Did your wife encourage you to take the job?
Yeah. My late wife at the time mm-hmm. encouraged me to take the job, and that's the best decision I've ever made because I was able to get the experience that I need mm-hmm. necessary to move forth in my career field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it seems in a way being in that bubble all those years, you almost have kind of a delayed maturity going on where you're not really, you're still kind of a kid.
Right.
You don't really know how the real world works. Was it kind of a rude awakening to be in an academic department and working for a university the way normal people do and suddenly realize you weren't a superstar on Sunday anymore? Was that a hard thing to adjust to?
That was very hard, Andy. Even when I parked at the facility, I was like, I thought we had parking right up front. But I said, George, you're not a player anymore. You have to walk. So that was very difficult for me. I was like, wow, this is different.
Right.
Because I was so used to being up front, you know, first class, having a chance to go first at everything, having the best of everything, mm-hmm. you know. So.
And what inspired you to get your PhD? Because that seems like a very ambitious thing to have done since you weren't, as you described yourself, you weren't a great student when you were a kid.
Right.
What made you decide to take such a bold move to do that?
Right, because I thought it was all about my family. My late wife at the time said, George, no matter what type of job you're going to have going forward, I don't think having a PhD would I don't think they're going to look down on you for having a PhD.
Right,
and it'd be great for our family. Because there's no one in my family or her family at the time who had a PhD or a law degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to reach my potential and mm-hmm. let my kids know and let my family members know that you can achieve whatever dream and a goal that you define. And so I end up, I was working for the Packers at the time, driving every Tuesday and Thursday night, driving 2 hours one way to Marquette University, taking night classes. I did that for over a year. The next thing you know, I was working at Marquette University, so it made it easier to take classes on campus. But it took me about 6 years, but I got it done.
Tell me a little bit about your dissertation.
My dissertation was the role transition of retired NFL players using a grounded theory. Mm-hmm. I talked to over close to 1,000 former players about their transition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just wanted to try to get some insight on how their transition was, because I really want to add to the body of knowledge, because there's not a whole lot of information out there about transition of players leaving out of college to the pros or from the pros into everyday life. So I said, you know what, this would be a great project. And also, too, it would be therapeutic for me because I was still struggling with the whole transition, not having an opportunity to be involved in a sport that I love so much.
Speaking of the sport that you love, one of the dark sides of the sport, of course, is the injuries that that athletes suffer. And there's been so much talk, and we've learned so much about head injuries in recent years, and there have been a lot of rule changes to try to make that not as big a problem. How do you feel about the rule changes? Are you a gladiator who wants the sport to be as tough as possible, or do you think they're necessary and they're a good thing?
Both. I'm a gladiator, and I like, well, I don't want them to change the sport. I want it I want the sport to still be recognizable for all of us diehard football fans, but we have to change the sport. Mm-hmm. And I think the leadership, whether it's on the high school level, college level, or the commissioner's office in the National Football League, they're going to put the proper rules in place to really help the sport, make the sport a better sport. Because I remember reading back in 1905, I think President Theodore Roosevelt was the president at the time, 19 young men died playing football. Mm-hmm. And that's when he called Harvard, Yale, and Princeton to the White House, and they was able to put some things in place to reform football. And out of those meetings and discussions, the NCAA was born. So whenever they've been some issues and challenges in football, administration has stepped up to help change and make the sport better.
Well, I've been speaking with George Kuntz, Jr. He played in the NFL with both the Green Bay Packers and the Seattle Seahawks. His book, Is There Life After Football? Surviving the NFL, is about the lifelong consequences of a career in football. It's published by NYU Press. George, thanks so much for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you.